I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a TV man.
Oh. Well, we have a psychiatrist.
Yes.
And I was a little bit interested in his reference to Usage Shock treatment. And he seemed to be saying that we discover the incidence of depression by how much shock treatment we use. I was just wondering, well, if you would use shock treatment if you had more depression.
No, we wouldn't, but comment was that people have come and been seeking to do research on depression on the assumption that we have a lot of depression in the hospital, and we don't. We simply don't have it, and I don't know where it is.
Well, she's referring to the kind of reaction we would expect from anybody under those circumstances. It's inconceivable to me that given those circumstances, we wouldn't have some kind of depression-like reaction to that. And whether it would be a more active or a passive kind of depression. I think given those circumstances, the fact that something like this, a reaction has to occur of some sort.
Well, Dr. Robert Benson once said it's better to be rich and healthy than it is sick and poor. And I sure go along with that. As a general assumption. When we get down to specifics and we make a statement of this kind about a general population, I think it can be misleading. I just don't know exactly.
Could I say something here? I think that what probably Mr. Orvik is attempting to get at least indirectly, I hope I'm saying this correctly. If I'm not, would you tell me, that he's suggesting that sometimes the use of psychiatric concepts which have great relevance in Western society are not necessarily as relevant when talking about a society from a somewhat different cultural basis. Is that what you're trying to say, Jim? Is that part of it?
I
don't particularly agree. I just thought that's what you were trying to say, and I just wanted to make it clear, you know, that I just wanted to make it clear because I thought maybe you didn't. Two more.
Yes, sir.
In the lower 48, the studies in the ghettos, we find that based upon records of hospital admissions, the people in the ghettos don't have the incidental, the minor health problems that you and I enjoy. They only have major health problems. This is, upon further studies of minor degree that have been conducted, is attributable to the procrastination and seeking medical care because of difficulty in obtaining access to hospitals, clinics, and so forth. Could it be that the same thing exists here in the way of depression doesn't seek professional care until it becomes psychotic or some grossly extended degree of depression?
To this point, too, in fact, what you're suggesting is, I think, may very well be operative in this situation and may explain partly what Jim Orvik was saying, that until depression reaches a state of depressive psychosis, it may not be socially disruptive enough in a village to be considered to be something for which somebody should be hospitalized. And in fact, many mild cases of ambulatory schizophrenia are never diagnosed as such because nobody ever sees them as such, and certainly in villages, if they can operate in other ordinary ways, that's just considered to be a peculiar quirk. This is so in other minority populations.
Yes, ma'am.
I have this weird feeling that language has a heck of a lot to do with what we're talking about, and I'm curious to know if there are any medical doctors or psychiatrists in this state who are fluent in the language of the people so that they can really interpret the symbols of depression.
Not to my knowledge. Many of us work with interpreters. And if there are any psychiatrists that are working with interpreters very closely, are you working with interpreters, Carl, at APR?
You rarely need them. Maybe that's another sign. The ones that speak English make it to the institute.
Dr. Chance.
In the early 60s, I did a health survey. So we're trying to, in an undertaking health questionnaire translated into Eskimo, and we tried to be particularly cognizant of the psychological translation difficulties and also of the cognitive ones. And we made numerous mistakes. I have written up, and it is a very good example of how we can misinterpret. If you took the straight research results without taking into account our mistakes, it would make some extremely unreal evaluation.
Well, I think it's very easy to deal, very easy, I'm sorry, I think it's easier to deal with TV than it is to deal with people outside of the money.
I would agree. Great.
Along the line of TB, I'd like to hear from Dr. Wilson some about the accomplishments and the abatement of TB. I think it emphasized the problems in which that we haven't talked enough about the problem.
Well, I think that might go on for a while, but I think one of the accomplishments, which are sort of a negative thing, is that we did accomplish a great deal more family disruption, and that's a negative accomplishment. I think that at the time we felt that this was indicated and indeed highly necessary, but since we are talking about the mental health problems, and I do believe that children particularly being separated from their parents for long periods of hospitalization, it was necessary to control the tuberculosis, but now we have some other problems. When we think about things from an ecologic standpoint, you attack one problem and maybe create three more.
It seems to me that what you did in TB was just a temporary thing because, as I understand, there had been no death in TB from TB in the last year.
No, there was no death from tuberculosis in any Alaskan, native or non-native, during calendar year 68. In 69, there has been one death that I know of in a native and one in a non-native.
How about the average length of hospital stay now with regard to the TB? Is it shortened?
Yes, it's much, much shorter now. It's 3 months now. In 1950, it averaged 2.5 years and was most often terminated by death rather than discharge cured.
So really, you're obviating your problem.
Yes, I think that's one thing that we can say very clearly is that tuberculosis is one of the diseases for which medical effort can make a very real difference. The other things that she mentioned are so much more complex, and that you need to, in order to make any gains on any of these, you have to have a real understanding of the feelings of the people and their whole entire situation. So it's not as simple. It's not, we don't have the one pink pill like we do for tuberculosis, and that's been, I think the effort's been applied well there, and it's been a coordinated effort, and I think all Alaskans can be proud of the accomplishments in tuberculosis control, particularly the native people themselves, because they are the ones that participated the most strenuously in the effort. The Alaska Department of Health is the Arctic Health Research Center, and all those people have really made a fine accomplishment.
Mr. Lukanoff?
Mr. Chair, I don't know whether this question is relevant to the discussion, but I'm just wondering if the anthropologists have gone into the study of the native religions, and if so, just how much of the native religion is left among the native people. We're trying to retain some of our culture. We're trying to marry two cultures so we can live normally, if that is possible. Whether the religious concepts that the natives had still influence whatever religion they have today. If so, have there been any studies along this line?
Oh, Bill, why don't you?
There have been some studies made, especially with regard to the Eskimo Aleut ideas of the supernaturalism. I don't know of many studies that have gone into the comparison or let's say an analysis of the present religious systems and to see how much is being done. I was just speaking to a young lady during the coffee break who was doing some of this summer in some of the villages on the lower Yukon, the Kuskokwim area. But I am definitely convinced, personally, from the research that I have done, that a good many of the ideas that formed the supernatural system, the worldview, let's put it that way, you know, because the word religion is a word that means different things to different people, but that the worldview which existed in the past is still, in good many ways today, exercising an influence on the worldview that the Eskimos or Indians are having today, with varying degrees of efficacy, with various degrees of influence. Just to use one example, for instance, I feel quite convinced that in the past, an Eskimo looked upon skill, or let's say the ability to shoot many seals or to get many walrus was not a skill that he personally acquired. This was a good supernatural connection. It was good luck. It was something that you could not really learn either. You inherited that, or you got this through an observance of a certain number of activities. And the result of that is that it is sometimes very difficult, I see this, I think, in relation to the educational system, that certain things cannot be learned. You inherit those, or you have it or you don't. And this causes a certain amount of fatalism. If it is meant for you to be, you're going to have it. If it is not meant, it's not going to be, and there is, for instance, no disgrace in giving up. I recall, for instance, one very clear instance of this, of some young fellows who were target practicing at the National Guard in Anchorage, and where one of the young fellows was standing to a very successful shooter, someone who was really hitting the targets, while the fellow next to him was not. And he said to me, if I had that target, I would hit it also. Which in his mind was the skill was connected with the target. It was a question of a connection. Well, I see this still existing in a number of situations, and so the worldview is definitely still influencing a number of things. Now, with regard to particular religious activities, I think a good many of these that have been superficially taken over, let's say in Catholicism, you have had just a substitution of elements. What before was a talisman in terms of a lucky stone which you put in your canoe, today use a medal, or you use holy water instead of something else, or you use a formula, let's say a Hail Mary or whatever it is, which in the past was a formula that you inherited. It's the same idea, sort of a magical approach to the same thing. It's kind of this idea that it's not really a skill, it's a luck, it's a supernatural connection. So this is, I think there is still a fair amount, and I think there is this would be a very, very fruitful field of observation. But this is where one of the people who really knows the language, and who, here it's really needed to speak the language, and someone who can really go into the whole worldview, which is very much tied up with the language. Anyone else want to? Dr. Lantis, would you care to comment on that?
In this regard, I think it might be fruitful if somebody made a systematic study of some kind as to the way that the native people perceive their language. We think of our language as a means of making our way through the world, and relative to your observations about child-rearing practices, how do we teach our children to become what they become? From a very early age, I think we have implicit in our culture that language is a manipulative device. We use it to change other people's behavior. In a real sense, it's replacing the gun and the axe. It's the way we make our way through the world. And so we grow up feeling that this is something that language can and should do. But is this as true in the native cultures, where one learns how to become an adult by watching, not by admonition or statements of right and wrong, but rather oblique means of influence, which to us seem terribly indirect and subtle, and we miss them usually. May this not have some transfer when a person who comes from a culture like this, when he learns English, may he not carry this attitude, this fatalistic attitude about you can't change your future by what you say, you just have to accept what comes. I think this is a very, something, a very fruitful field for someone to look into.
Yes, Dr. Shantz.
Comment briefly on a related discussion I think is very pertinent to this. Our research in Canada for the last 5 years with the Cree in northern Quebec has led us to come to the very strong conclusion that where you find native populations where the children grow up for the first 6 or 7 years speaking Cree almost entirely, then they move into an educational context where they speak English or French almost entirely, that the blockages in the learning process are really quite severe. And in the, we had considerable support for this idea in the international conference that I and several others have just returned from in Montreal, where we, all the circumpolar countries came together to discuss their educational policies and undertake or present the research data. And time and time again, it came out that if there are native teachers who take the major teaching role, this question of these severe cognitive conflicts are simply almost completely wiped out, and the learning process can take place far more effectively than when you introduce English as a second language, when French is, of course, the second concern. But where this does not take place, and of course, it's almost entirely the case in Alaska with almost all the teachers are non-native. This is another fundamental issue and a fundamental conflict in terms of effective learning, which shows up so dramatically when we get to high school. We get a lot of dropouts. There are many reasons for dropouts, but I think not sufficient attention has been given to this reason.
In this context, I just want to draw the attention of the audience to the fact that over half the native population of Alaska is less than 16 years old. In other words, in terms of education and self-image and what this is going to do, it's over 25,000 are going to be in the school system within a few years. Yes, Dr. Landis.
It was not done. In fact, I published a little paper in one of the sociological journals urging sociologists and others to come to Alaska to study the white population and their attitudes. It may be that the time has come now to do this at a conference, a national conference on education. 2 years ago, several people said that we have been testing school children for years and years and years, you know, but not testing teachers. The time had come to study the background of teachers. Where do the teachers come from? How are they recruited? What are their attitudes? Afterward, that a couple of people were doing just that. colleges in the schools, and oh, I don't know, I think in South Dakota, Mason, and some of the other places. There are generally teachers. Now, this may be just the beginning of a movement, let's hope so, that we do study both sides of this intercultural compact.
Mr. Orvick?
This might be the way to solve the native employment problem by hiring them all to study white
subjects. Yes, sir.
I can't help but think of your example, Dr. Lyons, of the two Eskimo boys that are shooting, and relating this to an educational situation where two boys took the same test at the end of a semester, and the boy that got the lower grade would attribute the fact that if he had the other fellow's test, he would have done better. You know, in his perception of the world view, this affecting his test taking in an educational setting.
Well, this is possible, of course. I have no, but I do know that I find youngsters at the university who drop out sort of give that feeling that it wasn't meant to be, and so it's not really, you know, they don't feel that you can, they do not feel, or they do not see things the way we see, if you really try and so forth, which is a totally different approach to the world. Mr. Three-Star?
I wanted to get back to the subject of representation. Our Canadian friends go home thinking that they don't represent themselves. I'd like to point out that I have sitting beside me a good friend of mine, some back here, that Bob Arden doesn't want to talk about because he's afraid that they might say something more. Well, I am too, but I would like to speak on their behalf that when they go back to Washington and speak on behalf of the entire nation, that's something else. When we can become before a group like this of scientists, that's something else too, because you are a resource people have their arm tapped for us to use. And not necessarily being on top of a Tennessee point of view. But I don't want to go home with the misconception that there is a high degree of correlation between acculturation and the need for psychiatric care, and I like that.
Yes, sir.
I'd just like to make a few comments on the representation on your board here. The question was raised earlier why more natives aren't here. And I'm not speaking for the Alaska natives. I'm Canadian and I'm from the Yukon, but the problems we have over there are similar to the ones that you were experiencing here. Now, has it ever occurred to the people attending the conference or to the board members that why should you come and say these things? Are they acted on? It seems to me that all the facts you presented here are things that can be picked up from talking to any Native person in the villages or going to the heads of these people here and just asking them. It seems to me that a lot of people are professional conference goers. They make it a hobby of hopping from place to place, and it's a form of amusement for them to sit and see where the Indian is this year. Is he higher in the social scale or below? And these things should be acted on. Is this conference going to get these suggestions through and acted on? Has it ever occurred to you also that any human being is going to tolerate being depressed for so long, he's going to become violent? And it's a thing you might have to look at up here.
I would like to respond to this for a moment. I at least would hope that of all the representation we have from all the various agencies and so forth, the people who are present here who have heard what has been said. Now, it is true that these things could be asked if you went to the right places and asked them individually, but at least here they have been said openly. They are presumably heard by people from the BAA as well as the public health services, the federal representation and so forth, teachers and education people. And so hopefully, at least I would hope that one result of this would be that they would carry those convictions home now and act upon them. Yes, sir.
Well, I have one more question. Just how much control do the Native people, say in the States, the American Native, have over their affairs? Like in Canada, just recently we've had a big problem. The Indian Act has been changed, and they've gone around and consulted the Indians, asked them what they wanted. But the actual making of the policy didn't really include, I don't think, any natives at all. And when the policy was presented to Canada or to the native people, it was rejected on the fact that no native people were on the board to help make up plans. Now, don't you think it would be a better idea for the native people to have more control, so they, you know, instead of having the white men leading them along and spoon feeding them?
Well, I am very glad to notice that in Alaska, a good many natives, Eskimos, Indians, Aleuts, are leading several white men along the path to very good solutions, I think. I think the Alaska Native is definitely making strides in taking his own affairs in his hands. He has done it by seeing the opportunity on the political and economic level, and he's taken it, and he can only be applauded for it and say, go.
I would like to observe, before some of the out-of-state and out-of-country visitors leave the room, there was an exchange here between a gentleman who read some letters to the editor of the Yankees Times, and, which I'm glad that he did. But he referred to Wien Airlines and their hiring of round-faced smiling Eskimos for photographs. Before you would leave, with the idea that Wien Airlines hires Eskimos to smile and pose with photographs, as an observer of Wien for many years, and one who has personal knowledge of them, I would suggest that perhaps one of the long-term members of the board be invited next year to explain to you why they have so many natives on their payroll. I personally know an Eskimo from the West Coast who flies a jet. I know an Athabascan from the Yukon who flies one of their new jets. I know many charming stewardesses who are Indian and Eskimo. They have many, many station managers, qualified, capable mechanics. And I'm sorry I spoke up at this because I'm not a participant. But before our out-of-state and our out-of-country visitors might get the idea that simply exploiting a round-faced, smiling Eskimo, I want to clear this up.
Thank you, ma'am. We have sort of agreed among ourselves that this would come to an end at 5 o'clock. We have gone over a few moments, which I think could make up for the few moments delay we had in getting started. I would like to thank the members of the panel for their kindness and their interest in being present and in discussing these problems with you. And I also would like to thank the audience for their participation. Thank you.